Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy. And today we'll be talking to Gary Hoover. Gary Hoover began his entrepreneurial journey at an early age. His question about enterprise was, what separates the losers from the winners? He began subscribing to Fortune magazine at the age of 12 and has acquired most of the back issues to 1930. He also began keeping a list of ideas for new businesses. As part of his education, he studied economics at the University of Chicago under Milton Friedman and two other Nobel Prize winners, served as a securities analyst for Citibank on Wall Street, worked as a buyer for Federated Department Stores, and headed up acquisitions and strategic planning for the May Department Stores Company. At the age of 30, after he finally took the plunge and created pioneering book superstore Bookstop, which helped change the nature of book shopping in America, this company was sold to Barnes & Noble for $41.5 million cash when it was 7 years old and became a cornerstone for their industry-dominating superstore chain. After he and his partner sold Bookstop, Gary returned to his first love of understanding businesses and began the company that became Hoover's, the world's largest internet-based provider of information about enterprises. Hoovers.com covers thousands of companies around the world. In July of 1999, Hoover's went public, and in March of 2003, the company was purchased by Dun & Bradstreet for $117 million. Like Bookstop, Hoover's has changed the way we do things and today employs over 400 people. Gary also ventured into the travel business with Travel Fest Superstores, which failed when airlines stopped paying commission to travel agencies in the museum industry with new conceptions of what a museum is and should be. He continues to add new ideas to his list of business ideas, now numbering over 230. In the 2009 academic year, Gary served as the first entrepreneur in residence at the Herb Kelleher Center for Entrepreneurship at the McComb School of Business at the University of Texas in Austin. There he focused on inciting inspiring entrepreneurial thinking among students of all types, graduates and undergraduates, inside and outside of the business school. He reviewed approximately 400 business plans and ideas in this role, as well as teaching a Foundations of Entrepreneurship course. In 2012, Gary was appointed Entrepreneur in Residence at the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin, and in 2015, a fellow of the IC2 Institute at that university. In 2009, he launched www.hooversworld.com, a blog which includes reviews of books, ideas, and places from Gary's iconoclastic angle. In 2011, he began a video blog which can be found at the same website. Beginning in 2010, Gary started teaching students of all ages entrepreneurial thinking through his own Hoover Academy. Understanding and researching companies are also popular courses. Over 300 people have graduated from Hoover Academy programs, ranging from 3 hours to 12 weeks. He also has begun offering online video courses. In the summer of 2012, he incorporated his fifth startup, Big Wig Games, to produce business and social science strategic simulation games for the iPad and other tablet devices, beginning with Restaurant Big Wig for the iPad. That venture continues while Gary has begun the next big idea. The Spark Factory was founded in the spring of 2015, develop and visit and build the Spark, which will combine an engaging interactive museum about innovation with a showcase for the latest and greatest products and services. Emphasis will be on the Internet of Things, games, social media, food, art, music, health, and technology. The company hopes to open the first location in Austin within 2 to 3 years. Gary lives in Austin, Texas, with his 56,000 book library. He speaks to conferences and corporate groups and works to encourage innovation and entrepreneurial thinking on every continent and in every industry for profit and not for profit. He has also supported the University of Chicago, where Hoover House Dormitory opened early this week. And welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Gary.
Great. Good to be here, Dave. Thank you.
Well, after that, I'd like to still hear a little bit of bio at your own words. Just tell us a little bit about yourself.
I mean, the background to all that, when I hear that, it sounds like I've been really busy, but it's just that I've been around a while. I grew up in Anderson, Indiana, a General Motors factory town, and the history teachers and everybody was talking about presidents and kings and queens and generals and battles and who had the right strategy, who had the wrong strategy, who were good leaders, who were bad leaders, what were their decision-making styles, why did people follow them. And General Motors had 27,000 employees in a town of 60,000 in Anderson.
Jeez.
So a huge force. And I said, well, what can you tell me about General Motors? It seems like it's pretty important here, too. And it turned out to be more important than I thought. Today there are zero General Motors employees there. But I was in a newsstand with nobody could answer my questions about General Motors. They said, oh, they make Chevrolet, Pontiac, Buick. I said, no, I know all that. I said, who started it? Why did they start it? Who runs it today? How do they think? And then in a newsstand with my parents and my brother and sister, I discovered the Fortune 500, the Fortune magazine's annual list of the 500 biggest U.S. companies. And General Motors was the biggest by far, 50% bigger than any other company in the world. And the magazine talked about how General Motors was created and what they were trying to do. And I went to my parents and, man, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. You got to get me this. And they did. And 2 months later, I entered the seventh grade. So I became a business junkie as a little kid and then soon fell in love with retailing and still love retailing and have spent much of my life studying and working in retailing and creating retail enterprises.
So you knew it from a very early age what you wanted to do.
Yeah. No, by the age of, I think I might have wanted to be the head of Procter & Gamble someday at maybe 10 or 11, maybe. That's really back in the mist. But certainly by 13 or 14, I wanted to be the head of either the big department store in Indianapolis called Ellis Airs or the ultimately run Marshall Field, the great Chicago store. And, of course, they're all gone now. They're all called Macy's.
Take us through your educational background.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, I think my best education came from high school in a lot of ways. That's where I had several teachers, three in particular, really changed my way of thinking or introduced me to new ideas and new ways of thinking. And that was just a public school in Anderson, Indiana. There were only two schools, so they were kind of everybody went there. And then I went to the University of Chicago, and I really, it's a liberal arts school. They don't offer undergraduate business. I knew I didn't want to study business because I figured I was already narrow enough, having read Fortune since I was 12.
So you already had a foundation there.
Yeah. Hey, and I heard all the business stories. I only had one business course in my life, really, and that was after I got out of college and my employer made me take it. So I was already soaked in business and loved it. And so I went up there. I majored in economics, which some people think that's tightly related to business. It actually, at the time I was there, there were very loose linkages between the University of Chicago Business School, now the Booth Business School, and the economics department. Today the links are closer. But yeah, I was just really fortunate. Actually, four of my teachers now have gone on to win Nobel Prize.
And you studied under Milton Friedman.
Milton Friedman, George Stigler, Robert Fogel, and Eugene Fama have all won Nobels. And then another, maybe the greatest of them all, Gary Becker, who I became friends with later, won the Nobel. He passed away last year.
What was that like after all those, to study under all those names?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is I really developed a love for economics. I think a pretty deep understanding of what's really important in economics and how it really works. Maybe kind of an intuitive feel for it, because economics to me is really a way of seeing the world. And a lot of what we see in the newspaper is highly mathematical models. That's become gone overboard, I believe, in recent years. And a lot of speculation. A lot of what I love is really microeconomics or price theory, supply and demand and how that works. And throughout my life, I have been surprised both by how little economists know about business and about how little business people know about economics. They would both be better off if they had a better feeling. But it was amazing, and I love the University of Chicago. It was another life-changing experience, or life-evolving, and because of that, even though I lost my money on my third venture, Travel Fest, before that, I gave the university enough that there's a Hoover House dormitory up there, so I'm still proudly engaged with the University of Chicago. It's a great place.
Very good. So right after leaving school, tell us about that. What'd you do?
Yeah, well, you know, I think by that point I knew I wanted to start my own retail chain, but I didn't know what kind, and I knew I needed to learn a lot and everything, and I didn't know what to do next for sure, you know. I guess I was probably thinking about going to work for a retailer, but in any case, my best friend said, well, why don't you go to Wall Street, become a retail analyst, pick retail stocks. I said, you've been going into retail stores and asked to see the managers and the presidents since you were 12, and so these people will pay you to keep doing that, you know. And I'm like, okay, maybe. They don't really teach you how to job interview in Milton Friedman's class, so I think I had 13 interviews and got one offer, but it was at Citibank, which then was a great company. They've had some strains, to put it mildly, since then, but it was run by a visionary banker, Walter Wriston, and a wonderful place to work. And an old-time analyst, Pete Wetzel, said, yeah, kid, I could use some help. And so I got the chance to, you know, our big investments were Sears, Penny, and Kmart, and I met the heads of those companies. And Pete, my boss, covered those, but then I covered the smaller companies, which are still pretty big, like Bloomingdale's, Macy's, Radio Shack, 7-Eleven. Those were some of the greats back there, and this would have been the mid-70s. But that was a wonderful learning experience, both to learn from an old pro like Pete Wetzel, but also to learn, meet all the heads of these companies and ask them what I thought were good or tough questions. And the department store industry, I've always loved that industry. It was so important to American culture and society. And now it's kind of on the wane. So that was my focus there at Citibank. And after a few years, I realized, it was really having the economists from all the big firms, the big brokerage houses, come speak to us. And I came to the conclusion, wow, these economists don't always really understand economics, at least not what I understood from the University of Chicago. And it made me realize, well, you know, some of the analysts really know what they're talking about. But some of them are just good talkers, don't really understand it. And that reconfirmed a notion I'm sure I had, that I needed to get out in the field and really touch retailing and really understand how it works operationally. I think a lot of young people skip that these days. So I quit my job, a big, nice job at Citibank in New York, stock analyst, and got a Greyhound bus pass where you could go 99 days for $99.
Right, I remember that.
No, it was great.
So what year was this?
Yeah, that would have been 1975. And I had interviews with at least 13 department stores around the United States. I guess I could count them up. I remember all the interviews. And ended up in Dallas working for Federated Department Stores, their big division there called Sanger Harris. So 2 years at Federated, and that really was the greatest of the big department store organizations. It later actually went bankrupt because the leaders had over-leveraged it, borrowed too much money to do, you know, like a leverage buyout. And so when the earnings, the profits, the cash flow takes a little dip, you don't have enough to cover the huge debt you've taken on. So even though the company is still highly profitable, you go bankrupt. And both they, Federated Department Stores, and arch rival Macy's, did the same thing, made the same mistake, both went bankrupt, they came out of bankruptcy, and Federated bought Macy's and then adopted the Macy's name. So that's how all that ended up. But at Sanger Harris in Dallas, again, I think just a little bit of luck. You know, I don't attribute too much success to luck. Just because if you do that, then it's not a good way to think about things. Even if it's true, you shouldn't believe it, right? Because then you'll sit around waiting for luck or you'll blame luck, and those are all pointless. But I definitely was very fortunate. I was fortunate to go to the University of Chicago. I was very fortunate that Sanger Harris in Dallas got a new management team from the Houston division of Federated called Foley, which was one of the most profitable and greatest department stores in the United States. And these guys, they came up just before I did. And so I really learned from some of the greats. And I still remember to this day, I talk about it in my book, Mr. Lazarus. The Lazarus family are the people who really put Federated department stores together initially by merging Abraham and Strauss in Brooklyn, Filene's in Boston, Lazarus in Columbus, Ohio, Shillitoe's in Cincinnati, and a year later, Bloomingdale's in New York joined them. And the Lazarus family kind of ruled the thing from Cincinnati, although it was highly decentralized. Each division, I have a podcast on my Hoover's World about Federated department stores and their management system, and I've talked about that in some of my posts that are on LinkedIn and Hoover's World. But the CEO, Mr. Lazarus, was only allowed to come to each division one day a year. And it was announced, and it was like a formal parade, you know. He went through department after department, and so So I'm standing, I was the book buyer. One reason I took the job at Sanger's was because they allowed me to be a full buyer, not an assistant buyer. And that was a great place to start learning and jump in and you know, be up a couple of rungs up at the very first starting position. But they gave me book department, so it's like it didn't matter if I screwed it up because it was such a small department. But anyway, and so I'm in there buying books, and that's where I came up with the idea for Bookstop during that era. And Mr. Lass was coming through the store. So you've got the chairman of Sanger Harris, the president of Sanger Harris, the senior vice president of all merchandising, the vice president of the basement stores or whatever, you know, the division we're part of, and then me, okay? And so like six of us lined up, and you almost like got saluted. Lazarus comes walking through, and it's time for him to talk to us, because each department was all lined up like that. He's walking through the store during business hours, and the chairman, Don Stone, the man who ran the Dallas operation, and they were really fighting. I mean, you could do whatever you want as long as you delivered your results and ran a great store, had a great reputation. And anyway, and Lazarus talked to him, the head guy, and saying this and this and this. And Don Stone, in the middle of it, says, excuse me. And he just walks away from his boss in the middle of the sentence, and he goes over and helps a lady who was looking for a book, maybe a Bible or something, in my book department. And you know what? He was trying to teach me, and I'm sure Mr. Lazarus totally understood this, he was trying to teach me that lady is more important than the CEO of the company.
Right.
And, you know, that's the kind of thing you never forget.
No, of course. You obviously have been
stuck
with
him. He went on to become vice chairman of Federated and the... it was a wonderful experience.
So then you're 30 years old, and then there's Bookstop.
Yep.
Tell us about
So I kept working in department stores for 2 years at Federated and 5 years at their competitor, Bay Department Stores Company, St. Louis, which owned Hex in Baltimore.
Oh, right.
And competed with Hutzler's, was the big guy there in town, and Hochschild Cone, and
Oh, right. You know all the stores, yeah?
Ago. I know all the department stores. So, anyway, while I was buying books at Federated, over all that time, at Federated, May, Citibank, the superstore idea was it was really invented in the late 50s. Charles Lass created Toys R Us. But it took him into the 60s and 70s to get rolling. So by the early 70s, Toys R Us was a public, independent company. And it was a revolutionary idea. I'm going to be not a general merchandise store like Sears or Macy's or Walmart. I'm going to be a specialty store. I'm going to carry toys and games and bicycles, whatever. And in that category, I'm going to carry a huge selection of goods and at low price. Well, today, you know, the biggest superstore chain ever built is called Home Depot. The next two biggest are Lowe's and Best Buy. But that was an unknown idea. And most great ideas, they don't make any sense. 99% of the time, they're laughed out of the room. If you have an idea for a new business, and all your friends say, that's a great idea, I wish I'd put it, you probably don't have a great idea. It's probably too easy to understand, too easy to copy. You might, but the odds aren't there. People would have laughed at the superstore idea because if you have a big selection of goods, you've got to charge higher prices to finance the inventory. And if, on the other hand, you're a discounter, you carry fewer items. You know, a Costco carries like 3,500 items, and a Walmart, a big one, can carry like 140,000, and yet the Costco does twice the revenue of the average
right.
Walmart because they're selling the high turnover items. So the idea of a big selection, low price, no, it won't work. Well, it was working. He was getting over 50% of the market in big metropolitan areas like Chicago and L.A., over 50% of the toys, which is a market share to die for, even Walmart in a big city would lust after 50%. And I said, well, this new technology, I call it, new way of running a retail store, this is really powerful. It's not just going to stay in toys. And so I figured, okay, I need to bring the superstore idea to some category of merchandise. But on the other side of the coin is, what are people going to be buying? And as a startup entrepreneur, I have to look 10 to 20 years into the future, because it's going to take 5 to 10 years to get the thing up and really speedy. While you have a few cases like Instagram that were flipped in a year or something, you know, even Google and Facebook stuff took 5 years, 6 years. And it's going to take that long to get rolling, and then it's going to have legs if you're going to either sell it or take it public.
But the technology was more advanced than when you started Bookstop, though, right?
The idea of the superstore as a technology, you know, you had to customize it to each one. And as far as technology, kind of hard technology, technology, hardware and software, there was no inventory control program that met my needs.
Right.
The bookstore idea.
So I had to write Bookstop my own started software. In what year?
Bookstop was 82.
Okay.
But to close that thought, so when I said, I'm trying to look 20 years in the future, it's the 1970s, so I'm trying to foresee the 80s and the 90s. And what I saw was the baby boom, biggest generation in history on one of them. So the key there is I wanted to sell whatever the baby boom is going to be buying, because clearly they would be driving consumer demand in the 80s and 90s. And when you study a generation like that, you look at both what are the age-related aspects. We were in our teens and 20s then, so you know you'd probably go to college. More of us went to college than any previous generation. You'd probably live in an apartment and fall in love, get married, move to the suburbs, and have kids and dogs and station wagons later in any event. So, and then the other end, being the best educated generation and given a lot of aspects of it, I felt our generation would have a bias for books and learning, for movies and music. So my list of ideas for Superstore was to do it in books, music, and then because we're going to have kids, ultimately toys, sporting goods, home improvement, and auto parts. And it took me some years to pick books, and when I was a book buyer, I put the ideas together. And it was 7 years after I decided on that idea till I finally quit my job at the May Company and took the plunge. Picked Austin as the best place in America to start it. Moved here 33 years ago and began to and raise capital.
Why did you decide that Austin was a good place to start?
Yeah, the thing is, I went out and tried to raise money for the idea of venture capitalists. You know, that's why a lot of people start. Oh, it ought to be venture capitalist. And I was too naive to know better. And they all said, oh, it'll never work. You know, the average B. Dalton and Walton Books, the two industry giants, they do $500,000 a year per store. You got to do $1 million a year to break even with big selection and low prices.
Right.
And I couldn't raise some money. I wanted to open a big one in Chicago, actually. I still had this plan. And so I said, well, I've got to prove I'm right. So where is the place where I can have the greatest chance of success for the least amount of capital? I want to say I had to raise $3 to $5 million for the big idea. So I came up with, I need $350,000, and I need to go to a place where the ratio of the demand for books to the cost of operating, owning, renting space, and advertising a bookstore is the highest. So what that meant, because the demand for books is highly correlated with the percentage of the population that have a college degree, and you had big concentrations of college graduates in big college towns, of which, for example, Boston and Los Angeles,
right,
the biggest college towns in America. But I couldn't afford advertising and probably not rent. On the other hand, like the most highly educated city in Texas is College Station, where the Texas A&M is, or Bloomington, Indiana, or Champaign,
right,
Illinois. Those were too small to support $1 million bookstore. So I had to go to a big college town. So it came down to Ann Arbor, Madison, Wisconsin, the Research Triangle, or Austin. Austin had the weakest competition, the fastest growth, was the largest of them. And I had lived in Dallas and fallen in love with Texas and the people and the skies and all the things that those of us who are now Texans love about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that aced Austin. And obviously it was very fortuitous. Austin is now, for what, 15 or 20 years, been the fastest growing major city,
sure,
in America. So,
and so it's you've been there ever since, 33 years, huh?
Yeah, and I ain't leaving. Although I love to travel, I've been to 44 countries, and if I could spend maybe a third or a half a year in Mexico City, I'd be there tomorrow. My most viewed blog post or newsletter was 10 reasons to jump on the next flight to Mexico City. I'm a one foot still in Hoosier Land in Indiana, and the other foot in Texas, and those two will never come out of the mud.
Wow. So you had Bookstop, and you sold it in...
Bookstop was 89 when it was 7 years old, and there actually the venture capitalist fired me and sold it to Barnes & Noble. But I'm glad that Barnes & Noble bought it. They did a wonderful job with the idea. They continued to build stores under our name, Bookstop and Bookstar, for a couple of years, and then they decided, no, we need to brand all these as Barnes & Noble, and they put in the coffee shops and more of a wooden mahogany library-like feel. But they've done a wonderful job with the company and run a great chain of stores. And I have no relationship with them at this point, but under very trying conditions with Amazon and ebooks and everything,
sure,
else.
So then, after that?
Hoover's was next. And my thing was, I'm standing there in the books. I collect reference books. My book library is up to about 56,000 books.
Right.
I'm an information junkie, not much fiction in there. You go into a bookstore, probably I estimate 70% of the revenue of a bookstore is people seeking information. 30% is people seeking entertainment. Now, obviously, a lot of books combine both. But, you know, fiction and novels and all that, maybe 30%, you mm-hmm. add it up. 70% of people want to know, how do I quit smoking? What's the best hotel in Calcutta? You know, what's
sure.
the best album of Mozart? Who won the World Series in 1936? How do I program in Java? You know, on and help, self-help. So, but you can answer most questions in a bookstore about sports or music or movies or anything. But if you came in and said, well, wait a minute, isn't Toyota bigger than General Motors now? Or didn't IBM
sure.
get into trouble? Any business, any question
so then what,
about business.
So how did you address that then?
Yeah, so I said, I want to create a mass market consumer book about big business. It's an annual book, an annual reference book, like an almanac. And every year we're going to have a page, a single page on each of the most important companies. And it was actually inspired. There was a book called Everybody's Business, written by a guy named Moskowitz. Back in the 70s or 80s. And it was wonderful. It did this kind of thing. It talked about each of the great companies, because nothing to me is more fascinating than great enterprises, for profit or not, how they were built, who built them, all the trials and tribulations. I was just this morning working on my next newsletter, and I think I'm going to use John Deere as an example. It was founded in 1837. It's now on its ninth CEO in 178 years. Nothing is more interesting than that. So we came out with an annual book. The company is called The Reference Press. Never really named the company after myself. But when we got into it with lawyers and brainstormers and creative people and our team, we named the first book Hoover's Handbook. I was going to call it like the Almanac of American Business or something. But everybody said, wait, that's going to be too easy for somebody to copy and we won't be able to stop there. You know, so I don't know. So I had a Hoover's Handbook. It was alliterative and Hoover's Handbook, and it was a 501 page each on the 542 most important companies in the world. And a couple of my old college buddies came down to help write it. They were in between jobs or whatever. And one of them, Patrick Spain, he'd been a lawyer, and he kept saying, well, the future is online. And we're like, what's online? Well, as a lawyer, he'd use dialogue and disclosure and all that jazz.
Yeah.
And so we're selling a book, a big fat paperback book, and he came out at Halloween of 1990. At 1991 on the cover for the next year. And what's selling the book is $20 in bookstores, big, huge, fat paperback, wonderful book, if I say so myself. And what's selling for $19.95, which means as a publisher, we get maybe $8, you know, after all the distribution margins, wholesalers. Patrick went to LexisNexis, I hope I don't embarrass myself here, the big legal information outfit. They were selling our book to lawyers at $10 a page and paying us $1 a page royalty. So for the 542-page book, we got $542 if somebody looked at all the pages, as opposed to $8. And it was all digital, you know. And I'm like, well, okay, that's pretty cool. And I got to the point, and the book was doing okay, but not like I'd hoped. And I said, well, Patrick, you want to run the company? You want to? And he said, yeah, but I'll morph it from being mainly books to mainly online. And we put Hoover's up on, he did, on AOL, which was a young, struggling company. We were even worried, could they pay their bills? And they bought it from us. And then and then AOL got big and powerful, and they said, now you need to pay us to put your Hoover's data on our site. And Freak said, oh, I don't think so. And he created Hoover's.com. I had to look it up, but it was early, maybe 93 or 4. We were one of the first websites, and he did a great job running the company. I stayed on the board for 13 years and learned. And watched the Believe in the Company, and then Dun & Bradstreet, it went public, and then Dun & Bradstreet bought it in 2003.
Great. So you always seem to be on the cutting edge of everything, right at the beginning.
I believe in innovation.
Serial,
I believe there's always a better way to do things.
The reason, actually, that I found out about you, I saw on LinkedIn that Robert Matney told me about the Spark.
Yeah.
Now, you start in the Spark, because I just interviewed Robert the other day, and he was telling me about how he... puts together technology and the theater.
Oh, yeah.
And this, I actually interviewed him back in October 2013, and that he has an app where the audience can decide the outcome of shows. It's a really interesting stuff. And then I got you up next. So talk a little bit about the Spark, how that came about, and what you want to do with it.
Yeah. As a little background, I'll be brief on that. My hometown, Anderson, Indiana, lost 27,000 jobs. That's 7 million square feet of empty factory buildings. And people up there, my old friends, said, well, what would you do? How would you reintegrate Anderson? And I came up with the idea of turning it into the greatest automotive tourism center in the world. I kind of think Disney World of automotive stuff and everything. It was a big concept. They had 7 million square feet of empty factory buildings that General Motors gave to the city. And I wanted one of those buildings, cheap real estate, and run with it. And I never sold the city government on it. Most of the business leaders were in favor of it. I don't think the city government leaders ever completely understood the idea of the power of tourism and all that.
Right.
And they really did. They tore down most of those buildings. They didn't really want to remember General Motors. In any case, so I moved the concept to Texas and was going to do a thing called Road Story USA. Put a team together, raised part of the money. I was out trying to raise the rest of the money in 2008 and hit the recession and couldn't raise it. So I tabled the project. But it gave me, I've now been to 600 museums worldwide. I've been to the museum conventions. I've read all the books. I've worked with these other people in designing that idea. And the real thing is museums. I did a piece, you can find it on LinkedIn or on Hoover's World, about, I think it's called 10 Things Museums Could Do to Come to the Modern Age.
Mm-hmm.
And I love museums. I couldn't go to 600 if I didn't. But so often, and one reason I was going to do it as a nonprofit originally, I changed to do it as a for-profit, because, and this will sound very strange, because it's very difficult for nonprofits to serve the public. The nonprofit organizations so often, not always, obviously I believe in the University of Chicago, but so often they only serve their donors, their priorities on how do we raise more money. The average, I was in a great science museum to buy all the tickets to all the parts of it, $60. I said, $60. They're open till 5 o'clock. I get there late, 4:45. I'm rushing through the exhibits. And they're like, oh, you gotta leave now. Why? Well, because, so we're setting up for the big party tonight, right? We're having a corporate party here. But I have nothing against corporate parties. I have nothing against donors. I am a donor. When I had money, I was a donor. I run retail stores. And you're not going to tell me to leave the store early. You're going to say, well, can't you stay a little longer? We're not even going to blink the lights until 10 minutes after closing time.
Yeah, it is funny like that, because they are really just, that seems to be their priority when it should be, their product, what their priority should be. Because one thing that gets me here is when I look at the museums here, sometimes they're closed on holidays.
Oh,
and I think
close Mondays. What the?
It doesn't that kind of, in terms of a business model, isn't that when most of your people can come?
Dave, you know what's even stranger is, a lot of the state border tourism centers that you, when you drive the freeways, you enter a state. A lot of those close at 5 o'clock, and some of those are closed on a weekend.
Yeah.
Whoa! What are these people doing?
It goes beyond logic. I don't understand.
So they're for profit. The model is a nearby neighbor of yours there in Baltimore is the International Spy Museum in Washington.
Right.
The National Museum of Crime and Punishment is also a for profit. The great Biltmore Estate in Nashville, North Carolina is a family owned business. And it's, one of the greatest historic houses in America. And, I love Baltimore. I love Baltimore museums. I love the B&O Roundhouse there. I love the aquarium. I was at Harbor Place when it first opened. I've given a number of talks in your convention center and all the rich history of that city. Go to the Spy Museum, man. At least they're open until 7 o'clock at night. And, they draw, over 700,000 people here at $20 a piece. And if you actually study the museum business, if you really think about the way a retailer does, it has a very high gross margin. Your marginal cost of delivering the service is tiny. Most museums, once you buy your ticket, the only people you're going to see are security guards who are often stolen. If I had 4 people who aren't security guards in my place, I'm going to give you 20 times as much human eye contact as a typical museum visit. I will be coming up to the level of maybe a Walmart or Home Depot.
Right.
I'm still light years away from Whole Foods Market. I served on their board of directors years ago, a wonderful company. Or Nordstrom's, another wonderful company.
But we'll talk a little bit more about the Spark. Let's get back to the Spark here.
Yeah. What the Spark is going to be is going to combine, it's going to be, in a sense, a museum of innovation. And because, yeah, our topic is innovation. And innovation broadly defined. Innovation in restaurants, innovation in hotels, innovation in language, innovation in music, innovation in art. Now, obviously, a lot of it is technology.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we're not going to be a science museum. But the other thing is we have so many of those different principles that you can see on Hoover's World, those 10 principles. We're open long hours, we're convenient, parking is convenient. We will be, we're shooting for all that. We change exhibits frequently enough that if you come back in 6 months or a year, it'll be a very new experience, at least in a major part. That problem, museums attendance tends to go downhill every year after they open. And retail stores don't, they go up.
Okay.
Because they're always renewing. You know, even if you take old merchandise out of the back room and bring it to the front, say, oh, look, we're having, you know, orange and black clothes the week for Halloween.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you're just be creative.
Well,
There's a lot of principles that make a difference.
Yeah, I lived in Europe for 10 years in the first part of this century, and there are places like Liverpool has a few wonderful museums, and they were like the first ones over there to make them interactive. And so they were always changeable. So you would come up and you would actually be in, like in the middle of a Liverpool football match, you know? So it was really fascinating type of thing is what you can do with you know, modern technology now. Instead of the, museums are terrific, but sometimes they just kind of stayed and look at the paintings and then that's it and you go away. And now they're becoming more interactive.
Now, and, you know, people are making progress. I mean, the children's museums and the science museums tend to be ahead of the others. And, you know, the Exploratorium in San Francisco is the first one to really be a totally interactive. But I definitely believe in deeply interactive. You're talking about England. I did the England tour a few years ago, but it was before Liverpool built some of those newer ones. I did some in Liverpool, a bunch in Manchester. One of the best interactive exhibits I went to was in Manchester. And there was no computers nearby. Interactivity doesn't have anything to do with computers. You know, it doesn't have to.
Right.
It was post-it notes and big pens where everybody came through, had to write their reaction. And no, we want our people to learn something, to have stuff to take away, to be an integrated experience. And our focus on innovation is on what's new and hot and forthcoming. So Kickstarter stuff, Indiegogo stuff, you know, and people will be able to try it, play it. So there'll be like a drone dome, a robot ring, a place where you can drive a Tesla or a Segway or whatever. And so part of our business model also is that we will collect revenue or commissions on sales or whatever from all these companies because so many companies don't have any retail shelf space to strut their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And yet people like to demonstrate it. And a lot of them aren't in a position, even if they wanted to, to ship to Best Buy or, you know, we got to do 800 stores, ship to them tomorrow, you know? And so a place, because we expect to build more than one Spark. First one's in Austin. But these will be fewer and farther between.
That's what I'd like to talk about. I'd like to see one up here.
Yeah. Oh, I would too.
In Baltimore.
I would too. Yeah, yeah. You know, to get our parking, we might have to go out to Towson.
Towson, that's where I grew up, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, they used to have a great bookstore there. There was an Independent. There was an Independent in
Towson.
Yeah. Can't remember its name, but yeah, yeah.
No, I know what you mean. I can't either, and I should. Like I say, I grew up there.
And hey, the Preakness.
On.
You know, the Preakness is such a wonderful thing.
Yeah. You're thinking that can open within 2 to 3 years in Austin. Where do you stand right now?
Yep. We're just in the very early stages. We're raising money. I've raised like 20 or 30 grand, and I'm always raising money. Somebody said, are you raising money? I said, look, if I'm not raising money, I'm probably dead. You know, and we're in the early stages. We'll need to raise a total of probably 6 to 8 million.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do that, there are basically a couple of routes you can go. One, I call it the big money route, and that would basically be to work with angels or groups of angels and put together a deal. You know, most businesses are not funded by venture capitalists. They're funded by angels. They have venture capitalists at their peak probably represented 5% of all funding. Maybe 3% now, it's hard to sort it out, but angels are how big businesses have already been started. Walmart didn't have any venture capital. Microsoft had very little, and it was later. Oracle didn't have it. And venture capitalists, I'm not knocking them, they play a very important role in certain industries over certain time frames. You know, if you've got an idea it's going to take them 15 years to get rich, they have no interest. You know, they got to enter faster.
Yeah.
So one way, and I wouldn't rely on venture capitalists if somebody wanted to come in, but they do so few startups these days, and again, within very narrow areas and ideas. They won't tend to do a bricks and mortar kind of thing or restaurants in general. Angels are much more diverse, often more patient. They can range from people putting in $5,000 to somebody putting in $5 million.
Sure.
The other route would be these new A-plus crowdfunded equity offerings that the SEC has just approved, which I've done crowdfunded equity 20 years ago before anybody else was doing it through an intrastate offering in Texas for Travel Fest. So I have experience there and the ability to advertise and just go out to regular people and have them invest $5,000 or $10,000 each or whatever. Has a lot of appeal, and it would also give us stockholder customers at the outset, which can really help with your buzz.
So how are you going to open it? What business type?
We're a C Corp. I always use C Corp. I've had, once an investor wanted me to change to an LLC, and we didn't. We did, because he was a big investor, and it was better for him.
Mostly C Corp.
Yeah, I almost always do a C Corp. I don't know, it's easier. I don't have to hire a lawyer, you know.
Yeah.
I can go on the Texas website and or whatever it is, $250, I'm done. I get to pay for it 3 days later or whatever. It's just straightforward. And how you do stock options, how you structure it, and the bylaws, you know, go to LegalZoom or whatever, it's all there. Whereas LLC, those are really, you know, each one in a sense is a customized structure and gets more complex. So, to me, that format doesn't matter that much. And actually, I think a lot of people are thinking about starting a nonprofit should think about making it a for-profit. And there's probably some people thinking about a for-profit that it should be a nonprofit or get creative and use some of the other forms of corporate organization we have at our disposal, like the mutual organization, the co-op organization, you know, Best Western, Ace Hardware, the Associated Press. Those are all great companies, you know, but they aren't, you know, you can't buy stock in them.
You have a lot of people in your group to work with.
What I'm doing now, I'm doing this more aggressively than I've ever had before. We have advisory councils, advisory boards. And, 12 or 13 people? We're adding another guy I met with yesterday. Those will continue to grow and probably evolve into specialized areas. They're basically kind of focus groups, talent recruitment methods, people we might want to hire someday. People are just smart that I want around the table in the early brainstorming session.
Right.
And so they're very diverse, you know, entrepreneurs, foodies, creative types. Robert Matney is on our advisory council. Some of them are people I've worked with before. Some I would love to have go to work for the new venture, but they may have, you know, may be real happy in their current jobs. So it's a very broad group of people, and we'll continue to grow.
Well, that's great. Well, I hope you keep me apprised, and I would like to be part of it. Because it sounds like a terrific idea.
I think so. Yeah. You never know. You know, it's always, all you can do is find something you love, that you believe in, that you think is somehow going to serve other people, make their lives better, and then just really throw yourself at it. And it doesn't always work. You know, I really did lose all my money and almost went bankrupt and had to sell the house and all that.
Yeah.
And
what pervades throughout your history is the passion. And that's really, I think, one of the most important things. Is to keep that passion.
You know, you're dead in the water without that. You got to love what you're doing. Oh, hey, if I didn't love starting these things and think I had a shot at it, I'd go work for some big company somewhere or something. Or actually, when I left Wall Street as a stock analyst, I thought, well, I can come back to this in my 80s because I don't have to be young to do this, and this is fun, and it's hard to justify getting paid just to study big retail companies. So I still do it as a hobby and email my friends all the time my comments on this company or that.
Okay, so we can safely say that you're going to be wanting to do this or doing this stuff till you drop.
Oh, yeah. No, I got, and now I'm up to over 300 business ideas in my list. I had two new ones last week. And I actually have longer term goals of things I want to achieve as I go out into like my 80s and 90s if I make it. And if I don't, just do the best with what I've done so far.
All right. Well, this has been terrific. I've enjoyed talking to you. How about giving me some contact info?
I can always be emailed by anyone. Gary Hu, my name without the E-R, so G-A-R-Y-H-O-O-V, at msn.com. That's an old email. It's been around a long time, but I like to keep it. Go to hooversworld.com to see my newsletters and my posts. And, you know, usually I teach classes. I teach classes here in Austin. Sooner or later, I'll put one online. those you can always find at Eventbrite. I got one tonight, and I got one Saturday, a four-hour intensive course for high school kids and students. About intensive course in entrepreneurial thinking. And then I'm all over YouTube. I've got about 90 videos on there. Most of them are entrepreneurship tips, but there's also time-lapse video that I shot around the world and different things. But Hoover's World's probably the best place to start with all the newsletters. They're also all on LinkedIn Pulse.
And for the Spark?
Same thing. It's on LinkedIn Pulse, but if you go to Hoover's World, you'll see
find that there. Okay,
there, right there at the top. Yep. And anybody wants to contact me about it, I just gave you my email address, and those I'm easy to find. I'm not hard to find. I don't have an assistant or anything. I'm out there. I probably mentor 3,000 entrepreneurs in 30 countries that email me all the time.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming on Baltimore Internet Radio. I appreciate it, and it was great talking to you. And like I say, I hope this is not a one-off. It's none of my programs are, and I want to keep apprised of what you're doing, and we can keep talking to each other if you like.
That'd be great, Dave. I really I enjoyed it as well. And sure, come up with an excuse for me to come up to Baltimore. And do
I'd love to. I will. Yeah, thank you very much.
Sure. I'm out on the speaking circuit here and there, and I love to travel, and I love all that. The only thing's a place like Austin, you know, our old historical buildings are about three blocks and a handful of buildings, you know, and so when I get up to cities with deep history like yours, it's wonderful.
Great. Well, thanks again, Gary. I've been talking to Gary Hoover. Is it safe to call you a serial entrepreneur?
Yes.
is that how you like to be referred to?
That's how I introduce myself. But it's funny, I'm so used to it that I once only people, well, what does that mean? I've never heard that. Down here in Austin, man, every other person is an entrepreneur, so that's the way you differentiate yourself.
Okay, great. Well, thanks again, and let's talk soon. This is Dave Custy, and this is Baltimore Internet Radio.